Chapter 5. The third generation. Scudamore Lane, sloping down riverwards from just behind the monument, lies at night in the shadow of two black and monstrous walls which loom high above the glimmer of the scattered gas lamps. The footpaths are narrow, and the causeway is paved with rounded cobblestones, so that the endless drays roar along it like breaking waves. A few old-fashioned houses lie scattered among the business premises, and in one of these, halfway down on the left-hand side, Dr. Horace Selby conducts his large practice. It is a singular street for so big a man, but a specialist who has an European reputation can afford to live where he likes. In his particular branch, too, patients do not always regard seclusion as a disadvantage. It was only 10 o'clock. The dull roar of the traffic which converged all day upon London Bridge had died away now to a mere confused murmur. It was raining heavily, and the gas shone dimly through the streaked and dripping glass, throwing little circles upon the glistening cobblestones. The air was full of the sounds of the rain, the thin swish of its fall, the heavier drip from the eaves, and the swirl and gurgle down the two steep gutters, and through the sewer grating. There was only one figure in the whole length of Scudamore Lane. It was that of a man, and it stood outside the door of Dr. Horace Selby. He had just rung, and was waiting for an answer. The fanlight beat full upon the gleaming shoulders of his waterproof, and upon his upturned features. It was a wan, sensitive, clear-cut face, with some subtle, nameless peculiarity in its expression, something of the startled horse in the white-rimmed eye, something too of the helpless child in the drawn cheek, and the weakening of the lower lip. The man-servant knew the stranger as a patient at a bare glance at those frightened eyes. Such a look had been seen at that door many times before. Is the doctor in? The man hesitated. He has had a few friends to dinner, sir. He does not like to be disturbed outside his usual hours, sir. Tell him that I must see him. Tell him that it is of the very first importance. Here is my card. He fumbled with his trembling fingers in trying to draw one from his case. Francis Norton is the name. Tell him that Sir Francis Norton, of Dean Park, must see him without delay. Yes, sir. The butler closed his fingers upon the card, and the half-sovereign which accompanied it. Better hang your coat up here in the hall. It is very wet. Now if you will wait here in the consulting room, I have no doubt that I shall be able to send the doctor in to you. It was a large and lofty room in which the young baronet found himself. The carpet was so soft and thick that his feet made no sound as he walked across it. The two gas jets were turned only halfway up, and the dim light with the faint aromatic smell which filled the air had a vaguely religious suggestion. He sat down in a shining leather armchair by the smoldering fire and looked gloomily about him. Two sides of the room were taken up with books, fat and somber, with broad gold lettering upon their backs. Beside him was the high, old-fashioned mantelpiece of white marble, the top of it strewed with cotton wadding and bandages, graduated measures, and little bottles. There was one with a broad neck just above him containing bluestone, and another narrower one with what looked like the ruins of a broken pipistum, and ostic outside upon a red label. Thermometers, hypodermic syringes, bistouries and spatulas were scattered about both on the mantelpiece and on the central table on either side of the sloping desk. On the same table, to the right, stood copies of the five books which Dr. Horace Selby had written upon the subject with which his name is peculiarly associated, while on the left, on the top of a red medical directory, lay a huge glass model of a human eye the size of a turnip, which opened down the center to expose the lens and double chamber within. Sir Francis Norton had never been remarkable for his powers of observation, and yet he found himself watching these trifles with the keenest attention. Even the corrosion of the cork of an acid bottle caught his eye, and he wondered that the doctor did not use glass stoppers. Tiny scratches where the light glinted off from the table, little stains upon the leather of the desk, chemical formulae scribbled upon the labels of the files, nothing was too slight to arrest his attention. And his sense of hearing was equally alert. The heavy ticking of the solemn black, clock above the mantelpiece struck quite painfully upon his ears. Yet in spite of it, and in spite also of the thick, old-fashioned wooden partition, he could hear voices of men talking in the next room, and could even catch scraps of their conversation. Eakin Dachan was bound to take it. "Why, you drew the last of them yourself. How could I play the queen when I knew that the ace was against me?" The phrases came in little spurts, falling back into the dull murmur of conversation. And then suddenly he heard the creaking of a door, and a step in the hall, and knew with a tingling mixture of impatience and horror that the crisis of his life was at hand. Dr. Horace Selby was a large, portly man with an imposing presence. His nose and chin were bold and pronounced, yet his features were puffy, a combination which would blend more freely with the wig and cravat of the early Georges than with the close-cropped hair and black frock coat of the end of the 19th century. He was clean-shaven, for his mouth was too good to cover, large, flexible, and sensitive, with a kindly human softening at either corner which with his brown sympathetic eyes had drawn out many a shame-struck sinner's secret. Two masterful little bushy side whiskers bristled out from under his ears, spindling away upwards, to merge in the thick curves of his brindled hair. To his patients there was something reassuring in the mere bulk and dignity of the man. A high and easy bearing in medicine as in war bears with it a hint of victories in the past, and a promise of others to come. Dr. Horace Selby's face was a consolation, and so too were the large, white, soothing hands, one of which he held out to his visitor. "I am sorry to have kept you waiting. It is a conflict of duties, you perceive, a host to his guests and an advisor to his patient. But now I am entirely at your disposal, Sir Francis. But dear me, you are very cold." "Yes, I am cold." "And you are trembling all over." "Tut, tut, this will never do. This miserable night has chilled you. Perhaps some little stimulant." "No, thank you. I would really rather not. And it is not the night which has chilled me. I am frightened, doctor." The doctor half turned in his chair, and he patted the arch of the young man's knee, as he might the neck of a restless horse. "What then?" he asked, looking over his shoulder at the pale face with the startled eyes. Twice the young man parted his lips. Then he stooped with a sudden gesture, and turning up the right leg of his trousers he pulled down his sock and thrust forward his shin. The doctor made a clicking noise with his tongue as he glanced at it. "Both legs?" "No, only one." "Suddenly?" "This morning." "Hum." The doctor pouted his lips, and drew his finger and thumb down the line of his chin. "A new account for it?" he asked briskly. "No." A trace of sternness came into the large brown eyes. "I need not point out to you that, unless the most absolute frankness," the patient sprang from his chair. "Oh, help me God," he cried, "I have nothing in my life with which to reproach myself. Do you think that I would be such a fool as to come here and tell you lies? Once for all, I have nothing to regret." He was a pitiful, half-tragic and half-grotesque figure, as he stood with one trouser leg rolled to the knee, and that ever-present horror still lurking in his eyes. A burst of merriment came from the card players in the next room, and the two looked at each other in silence. "Sit down," said the doctor abruptly, "your assurance is quite sufficient." He stooped and ran his finger down the line of the young man's shin, raising it at one point. "Sir Pigeonus," he murmured, shaking his head. "My other symptoms? My eyes have been a little weak. Let me see your teeth." He glanced at them, and again made the gentle, clicking sound of sympathy and disapprobation. "Now your eye." He lit a lamp at the patient's elbow, and holding a small crystal lens to concentrate the light, he threw it obliquely upon the patient's eye. As he did so, a glow of pleasure came over his large expressive face, a flush of such enthusiasm as the botanist feels when he packs the rare plant into his tin knapsack, or the astronomer when the long-sought comet first swims into the field of his telescope. "This is very typical indeed," he murmured, turning to his desk and jotting down a few memoranda upon a sheet of paper. "Curiously enough, I am writing a monograph upon the subject. it is singular that you should have been able to furnish so well-marked a case. He had so forgotten the patient and his symptom that he had assumed an almost congratulatory air towards its possessor. He reverted to human sympathy again, as his patient asked for particulars. My dear sir, there is no occasion for us to go into strictly professional details together, said he soothingly. If, for example, I were to say that you have interstitial keratitis, how would you be the wiser? There are indications of a strumastiathesis. In broad terms, I may say that you have a constitutional and hereditary taint. The young baronet sank back in his chair, and his chin fell forwards upon his chest. The doctor sprang to a side table and poured out half a glass of liqueur brandy which he held to his patient's lips. A little fleck of color came into his cheeks as he drank it down. Perhaps I spoke a little abruptly, said the doctor, but you must have known the nature of your complaint. Why, otherwise, should you have come to me? God help me, I suspected it, but only today when my leg grew bad. My father had a leg like this. It was from him then, No, from my grandfather. You have heard of Sir Rupert Norton, the great Corinthian? The doctor was a man of wide reading with a retentive memory. The name brought back instantly to him the remembrance of the sinister reputation of its owner, a notorious buck of the 30s, who had gambled and dueled, and steeped himself in drink and debauchery, until even the vile set with whom he consorted, had shrunk away from him in horror, and left him to a sinister old age with the barmaid wife whom he had married in some drunken frolic. As he looked at the young man still leaning back in the leather chair, there seemed for the instant to flicker up behind him some vague presentiment of that foul old dandy with his dangling seals, many-wreathed scarf, and dark satiric face. What was he now? An armful of bones in a moldy box. But his deeds, they were living and rotting the blood in the veins of an innocent man. I see that you have heard of him, said the young baronet. He died horribly, I have been told, but not more horribly than he had lived. My father was his only son. He was a studious man, fond of books and canaries and the country, but his innocent life did not save him. His symptoms were cutaneous, I understand. He wore gloves in the house. That was the first thing I can remember. And then it was his throat. And then his legs. He used to ask me so often about my own health, and I thought him so fussy, for how could I tell what the meaning of it was? He was always watching me, always with a sidelong eye fixed upon me. Now, at last, I know what he was watching for. Had you brothers or sisters? None, thank God. Well, well, it is a sad case, and very typical of many which come in my way. You are no lonely sufferer, Sir Francis. There are many thousands who bear the same cross as you do. But where is the justice of it, doctor? Cried the young man, springing from his chair and pacing up and down the consulting room. If I were heir to my grandfather's sins as well as to their results, I could understand it, but I am of my father's type. I love all that is gentle and beautiful, music, and poetry and art. The coarse and animal is abhorrent to me. Ask any of my friends and they would tell you that. And now that this vile, loathsome thing, I am polluted to the marrow, soaked in abomination. And why? Haven't I a right to ask why? Did I do it? Was it my fault? Could I help being born? And look at me now, blighted and blasted, just as life was at its sweetest. Talk about the sins of the Father, how about the sins of the Creator? He shook his two clenched hands in the air, the poor impotent atom with his pinpoint of brain caught in the whirl of the infinite. The doctor rose and placing his hands upon his shoulders he pressed him back into his chair once more. Here, there, my dear lad, said he, you must not excite yourself. You are trembling all over. Your nerves cannot stand it. We must take these great questions upon trust. What are we, after all? Half-evolved creatures in a transition stage, nearer perhaps to the Medusa on the one side than to perfected humanity on the other. With half a complete brain we can't expect to understand the whole of a complete fact, can we, now? It is all very dim and dark, no doubt, but I think that Pope's famous couplet sums up the whole matter, and from my heart, after 50 years of varied experience, I can say, but the young baronet gave a cry of impatience and disgust. Orts, words, words. You can sit comfortably there in your chair and say them, and think them too, no doubt. You've had your life, but I've never had mine. You've healthy blood in your veins, mine is putrid. And yet I am as innocent as you. What would words do for you, if you were in this chair, and I in that? Ah, it's such a mockery and a make-believe. Don't think me rude, though, doctor. I don't mean to be that. I only say, that it is impossible for you, or any other man to realize it. But I've a question to ask you, doctor. It's one on which my whole life must depend. He writhed his fingers together in an agony of apprehension. Speak out, my dear sir. I have every sympathy with you. Do you think the poison has spent itself on me? Do you think that, if I had children they would suffer? I can only give one answer to that. _ third and fourth generation, _ says the trite old text. You may in time eliminate it from your system, but many years must pass before you can think of marriage. I am to be married on Tuesday, whispered the patient. It was the doctor's turn to be thrilled with horror. There were not many situations which would yield such a sensation to his seasoned nerves. He sat in silence, while the babble of the card table broke in upon them again. He had a double ruff, if you had returned a heart, was bound to clear the trumps. They were hot and angry about it. How could you? Cried the doctor severely. T was criminal. You forget that I have only learned how I stand today. He put his two hands to his temples, and pressed them convulsively. You are a man of the world, Dr. Selby. You have seen or heard of such things before. Give me some advice. I'm in your hands. It is all very sudden and horrible, and I don't think I am strong enough to bear it. The doctor's heavy brows thickened into two straight lines, and he bit his nails in perplexity. The marriage must not take place. Then what am I to do? At all costs it must not take place. And I must give her up? There can be no question about that. The young man took out a pocketbook, and drew from it a small photograph, holding it out towards the doctor. The firm face softened as he looked at it. It is very hard on you, no doubt. I can appreciate it more now that I have seen that. But there is no alternative at all. You must give up all thought of it. But this is madness, doctor, madness, I tell you. No, I won't raise my voice. I forgot myself. But realize it, man. I am to be married on Tuesday. This coming Tuesday, you understand. And all the world knows it. How can I put such a public affront upon her? It would be monstrous. Nonetheless, it must be done. My dear lad, there is no way out of it. You would have me simply write brutally, and break the engagement at the last moment without a reason. I tell you I couldn't do it. I had a patient once who found himself in a somewhat similar situation some years ago, said the doctor thoughtfully. His device was a singular one. He deliberately committed a penal offense, and so compelled the young lady's people to withdraw their consent to the marriage. The young baronet shook his head. Why, personal honor is as yet unstained, said he. Have little else left, but that, at least, I will preserve. Well, well, it is a nice dilemma, and the choice lies with you. Have you no other suggestion? You don't happen to have property in Australia? None. But you have capital? Yes. Then you could buy some. Tomorrow morning would do. 1,000 mining shares would be enough. Then you might write to say that urgent business affairs have compelled you to start at an hour's notice to inspect your property. That would give you 6 months, at any rate. Well, that would be possible. Yes, certainly, it would be possible. But think of her position. The house full of wedding presents, guests coming from a distance. It is awful. And you say that there is no alternative. The doctor shrugged his shoulders. Well, then, I might write it now, and start to dash morrow, eh? Perhaps you would let me use your desk. Thank you. I am so sorry to keep you from your guests so long. But I won't be a moment now. He wrote an abrupt note of a few lines. Then with a sudden impulse he tore it to shreds and flung it into the fireplace. "No, I can't sit down and tell her a lie, doctor," he said rising. "He must find some other way out of this. I will think it over and let you know my decision. You must allow me to double your fee as I have taken such an unconscionable time. Now goodbye, and thank you a thousand times for your sympathy and advice. Why, dear me, you haven't even got your prescription yet. This is the mixture, and I should recommend one of these powders every morning, and the chemist will put all directions upon the ointment box. You are placed in a cruel situation, but I trust that these may be but passing clouds. When may I hope to hear from you again? Tomorrow morning. Very good. How the rain is splashing in the street. You have your waterproof there. You will need it. Goodbye, then, until tomorrow." He opened the door. A gust of cold, damp air swept into the hall. And yet the doctor stood for a minute or more watching the lonely figure which passed slowly through the yellow splotches of the gas lamps, and into the broad bars of darkness between. It was but his own shadow which trailed up the wall as he passed the lights, and yet it looked to the doctor's eye as though some huge and somber figure walked by a mannequin's side and led him silently up the lonely street. Dr. Horace Selby heard again of his patient next morning, and rather earlier than he had expected. A paragraph in the Daily News caused him to push away his breakfast untasted, and turned him sick and faint while he read it. "Deplorable accident," it was headed, and it ran in this way. "A fatal accident of a peculiarly painful character is reported from King William Street. About 11 o'clock last night a young man was observed, while endeavoring to get out of the way of a hansom, to slip and fall under the wheels of a heavy two-horse dray. On being picked up his injuries were found to be of the most shocking character, and he expired while being conveyed to the hospital. An examination of his pocketbook and card case shows beyond any question that the deceased is none other than Sir Francis Norton, of Dean Park, who has only within the last year come into the baronetcy. The accident is made the more deplorable as the deceased, who was only just of age, was on the eve of being married to a young lady belonging to one of the oldest families in the South. With his wealth and his talents the ball of fortune was at his feet, and his many friends will be deeply grieved to know that his promising career has been cut short in so sudden and tragic a fashion." Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.